Young men are forever casting their meager will and intellect against the tide of their passions, claiming they do not fear when they fear, insisting they do not love when they love. So the young king of Sarkarpus told himself that he despised Anna Serimbasova, cursed her as the self-important daughter of his enemy, even as he mooned over the similarity of their names and the poetry of their conjunction. Serwa and Sorwheel, Sorwheel and Serwa, even as he dreamed of their tender coupling. Even as he began fearing more for her, a Gnostic sorceress, than for himself. When he asked her whether she was worried about being a hostage, she simply shrugged and said, "The ghouls mean us no harm. Besides, we are children of fate. What is there for us to worry?" And indeed, the more time he spent with her, the more this seemed to characterize her. The absence of worry. Equanimity, soothing for its constancy, arrogant for its extent. So this Nonman king, Nilgicus, what are you to offer him? Nothing. We are the terms of the negotiation, Horse King, not the framers. So we are to be captives, nothing more? He almost always found her smile dazzling, even when he knew she laughed at him and his barbaric ignorance. "Nothing more," she said. "We will languish safe and useless, while the great ordeal carries the burden of the apocalypse." And he could not but exult at the thought of languishing with Anna Serimbasova. Perhaps, he found himself hoping, she might come to love him out of boredom. Days had passed, and her demeanor remained every bit as wry and reflective as the day when he first met her in Caiutus's tent. She carried an aura of power, of course, as much for the miraculous way she whisked them from place to place as for the dizzying facts of her station and her blood. Grand Mistress and Princess Imperial, Archmage and Anna Serimber. Nevertheless, her youth and sex continually beguiled Sorwheel into thinking she was a mere girl, someone weaker, simpler, and as much a victim of circumstance as he himself. And perhaps this was what he needed her to be, for no matter how many times her knowledge and intellect contradicted this image, it would reassert itself. Sometimes she astonished him, so subtle were her observations, and so complete was her knowledge of the ancient lands they crossed. And yet, within a handful of heartbeats, she would inevitably lapse into the alluring waif, the one who would find such security in his arms, if only she would let him embrace her. He would be long in appreciating the stamp of ancient profundity she carried in her soul. "This Nilgicus, do you know much of him?" "I was his friend once, ere the first end of the world." "And?" Though they were of an age, sometimes her look made him seem a thousand years his senior. "He was wise, powerful, and unfathomable. The Nonmen resemble us too much not to continually fool us into thinking we comprehend them. But they always surprise, sooner or later." If Serwa embodied serenity, Moengus was nothing short of mercurial. Sorwheel had never forgotten Caiutus's warning to beware his brother's madness. Even Serwa had mentioned Moengus's foul humors, as she called them. Some days, as opposed to mere watches, would pass with the Prince Imperial speaking nary a single word. Sorwheel quickly learned to avoid him altogether during these periods, let alone refrain from speaking to him. The most innocuous question would spark a murderous glare, one all the more lunatic for the white-blue of his unblinking eyes, and all the more frightening for the vigor of his frame. Then, over the course of a night or a day, whatever besieged him would lift, and he would resume his more sociable manner, wry and observant, quick to tease, and often outright considerate, especially when it came to his sister, to the point of risking his neck for eggs or wading through marsh muck for tubers, anything that might delight her when they took their evening repast. "What makes you so worthy?" Sorwheel once asked her, while Moengus crouched on the river bank nearby, trolling the waters with a string and hook. She drew her hair back to regard him, a gesture the Sekarpi king had fallen in love with. "Pody always says that aside from Mother, I'm the only Anasarimber he likes." Pody, Sorwheel had learned, was the genetic diminutive for older brother, a term of endearment and respect. "My sister is sane," Moengus called from his perch, over the flashing water. Cirrus scowled and smiled at once. "He thinks my family is crazy." "Your family?" Sorwheel asked. She nodded as if recognizing some previously discussed inevitability, truths that they would have no choice but to share because of the intimacies of the trail. "He's my brother, yes, but we share no blood. He's the son of my father's first wife, my namesake, Sirwi, the one whose corpse they found with father on the Circumfix during the First Holy War, the one everyone is loath to speak about." "So he's your half-brother?"
"No. Have you heard of Nayer Urs Gyotha?"
Even from a distance, Moengus seemed to stiffen.
"No."
She glanced at her brother with something resembling relish. "He was a Skilvendi barbarian famed for his martial exploits in the First Holy War, and now venerated for his service to my father, I'm told," she called out teasingly. "There's even a cadre of fools who scar their arms like Skilvendi in the ordeal."
"Bah!"
her brother cried.
"Why does he think you're blood crazy?" Sorwheel pressed, eager to sidestep the topic of Moengus's paternity.
Sarah cast another laughing look at the dark-haired man.
"Because they think about thoughts," Moengus said, looking over his shoulder.
Sorwheel frowned. He had always thought this the definition of wisdom.
"And this is crazy?"
Moengus shrugged.
"Think about it."
"Father," Sorwheel explained, "says that we have an extra soul, one that lives, and another that watches us living. We are prone to be at war with ourselves, the Anasarimber."
Her terms were simple enough, but Sorwheel suspected she understood the matter with a philosopher's subtlety.
"So your father thinks you crazy?"
Both siblings laughed at this, though Sorwheel had no inkling as to the humor.
"My father is Dunyain," Sorwheel said. "More human than human. His seed is strong, apt to crack the vessels that bear it."
"Tell him about our brother Inri," she crinkled her sunburned brow. "I would rather not."
"What are Dunyain?" Sorwheel asked, speaking with the curiosity of those wishing to pass the time. "Nothing more," when in fact his breath ached for interest.
She looked to her brother once again, who shrugged and said,
"No one knows."
Sarah leaned her head low, almost sideways, so that her hair fell in a silk sheet. It was a girlish gesture, one that again reminded the Sekarpi king that for all her worldliness and self-possession, she was scarcely older than he.
"Mother once told me they dwelt someplace in the northern wastes, that they have spent thousands of years breeding themselves the way Kyanin breed horses, or the Inani breed dogs, breeding and training."
Sorwheel struggled to recall what it was Zeronga had told him about the heretic, the wizard named Akamian, and his claims against the Aspect Emperor.
"Breeding and training for what?"
She looked at him with a wisp of a scowl, as if noting a regrettable sluggishness in his soul.
"To grasp the absolute."
"Absolute?"
he asked, speaking the word, which he had never before heard, slowly, as to make it his own.
"Ho!" Moengus called, yanking a small bass onto the river bank. It thrashed silver and gold, even as it blackened the bare stone with wetness.
"The god of gods," Sowa said, beaming at her brother.
The men of the Circumfix were born to proud war. Most of them had been tested on a dozen battlefields and had not so much developed a contempt for numbers as an appreciation for skill in training. They had seen single companies of hard-bitten knights rout whole armies of orthodox rabble. Numbers often meant nothing on the field of war. But there were numbers, and there were numbers. A mob, when it became great enough, became a living thing, vast and amorphous, shrinking when pricked, engulfing when roused, always too numerous to possess a singular will. The horde, the Believer Kings were beginning to realize,
was unconquerable, simply because it was too enormous to ever realize that it was conquered.
"Ours is the station of glory," King Umrapather declared, "for we have been given the yoke of victory. The fate of the great ordeal now turns upon us, the very fate of the world, and we shall not fail. Ours is the station of death,"
Karindusu cried out in heretical contradiction. And indeed, despite the lofty rhetoric of their lords, a presentiment of doom began shadowing the hearts of the common warriors. They were simple men for the most part, hailing from Serange, Girgash, Nilnamesh, and beyond. They thirsted, and they starved. They had marched to the ends of the earth, into lands where cities were overgrown graves, surrounded by an enemy they could not close with, whose numbers curtained the very sky with dust. They had witnessed the might of the schoolmen. They knew the indomitable strength of their mounted lords. And now they knew that power, for all its miraculous glory, was not but a nuisance to their inscrutable foe. What difference could their hungry ranks make? No one dared speak this question, not so much for fear of the judges as for fear of the answers. But it began filing down the sharp edge of their resolve, nevertheless. The songs they raised became ever more listless and half-hearted, until many of their caste nobles forbade singing altogether. Soon the army of the south trudged in exhausted silence. Fields of dusty men, shambling without spark or purpose, their faces blank with long-hanging apprehension. In the evenings, they swap rumors of doom while gnawing on their meager repast. The attempts to clear their flanks were abandoned. The losses among the cavalry, in particular, had become prohibitive. Other tactics were explored, especially with regards to the culling. But an air of ritual futility began subverting their efforts, arcane or otherwise. Daily the interval tolled, and the pickets rolled out. The schoolmen walked the low sky above them, and together they pricked the elephantine horde with mere needles. The true fanatics among the Zadunyani, those who repelled for the violence of their belief, began haranguing the more skeptical souls, for their thoughts were so disordered as to see redemption in the horror looming about them. Of those they exhorted, some took heart, but many others took exception. Fights began breaking out among the nobles and menials alike, many of them lethal. The judges found themselves condemning ever more men to the lash and gibbet. Meanwhile, the horde grew ever greater, until its unearthly howl could be heard at all times. At night men held their breath, listening, and despaired. To his father's chagrin, Prince Charapatha told the council about the typhoon he once survived at sea. "Sunlight fell," he said, his eyes vacant with unwelcome recollection. "You could drop a feather onto the deck, so calm was the wind. Yet thunderheads wreathed the whole world about us, a ring of dark that would span nations." He looked across the assembled lords of the ordeal. "I fear we march in just such an eye of false peace." Afterwards, in privacy of his pavilion, Umrapather struck his famed son across the mouth. Such was his outrage. "Speak of glory, if you speak at all," he roared. "Speak of will and iron and enemies gagging beneath your heel. Are you such a fool, Chera? Can you not see that fear is our foe? By feeding it, you feed them, even as you rob us of the stomach to fight." And Charapatha wept. Such was his shame. He repented, vowed never to speak save in the name of hope and courage. "Belief, my son," Umrapatha said, wondering that a famed hero such as his son could still act a little boy in paternal eyes. "Belief empowers men far more than knowledge." And so was their rift healed with respect and wisdom. What father does not correct his son? But several among their households overheard their quarrel, and rumors of discord and indecision slipped from tongue to ear to tongue, until the host feared their king-general desperate and weak. Umrapather, it was said, had stopped his ears even to those he loved,
and would no longer countenance the truth.
The three hostages-to-be had come to what seemed a great forested basin, so vast its outer rim rose into the hazed oblivion, but proved to be a valley. A river wound through it, roping across the floodplains in meandering loops, broad enough to enclose slender islands. "The holy Omris," Serwa declared, awed and excited despite the toll of their leap. "The very nursery of Mannish civilization."
This was how they found it, the first men who set foot in this vale so many thousands of years ago.
While she slept, Sowheel found a seat overlooking the vista between the roots of a towering oak that stood poised over a slope so steep as to seem half of a gorge. He sat dozing, watching as the iron dark of the river transformed with the climbing sun, becoming green and brown and blue, and along certain sections a miraculous silver. The river Omris, where the high Nocerai had raised the first great cities of stone, where men had knelt like children at the knee of their non-men foes, and learned the ways of art and commerce and sorcery. Some time passed before he saw the ruins. At first he noticed only their sum, like a ghostly pictogram glimpsed through the trees, lines writ for the heavens to read. Then he found himself picking out individual words, some actual breaching the forest canopy, the arcs of dead towers, the lines of once imposing fortifications. Where before he had gazed across mere wilderness, now he peered across a monumental cemetery, a place humming with loss and history. It seemed absurd, even impossible, that he had failed to see it. But there it was, as clear as a Galeoth tattoo, only laid across the reach of the earth. The remains of some mighty city. Serwa began crying out in her sleep so violently as to send both Sowheel and Moengus sprinting to her. The Prince Imperial shrugged Sowheel aside when he hesitated over her thrashing form, then pulled her in his powerful embrace. She awoke sobbing. For some reason, the sight of her clutching her brother with weeping gratitude unnerved him as much as anything he had witnessed since Sir Carpus's fall. Everything but everything seemed to attest to the righteousness of the Aspect Emperor's war against the world's second ending. The sheer might of the great ordeal, Aeschylus and his unnerving lesson on the plain, the skin spy so dramatically revealed in the umbilicus, the terror of the Horde and the cunning of the Ten Yoke Legion, even the trust and charity of the Anor Serimbur had extended to him, their enemy. Not to mention the shining presence of the Aspect Emperor himself. She had dreamed of the nameless city below them, Sowheel knew. She had relived the horror of its destruction, even as he had pondered its overgrown imprint. And it struck him breathless, stationary in a way he had never known. The sight of her weeping somehow resurrected the circumstances that had so reduced her, a woman who seemed impervious to grief. He could almost hear the horns clawing the wind, glimpse the dread whirlwind that Aeschylus had always described in hand-wringing tones. Nothing is quite so easy as dismissing the folly of the dead, so long as they remain dead. She brought them to the ruins, though she could have leapt much farther, across the valley if need be. The cant taxed her as profoundly as any, but she insisted on wandering with them, through the ruins of ancient Trice, the holy mother of cities. The trees towered, formed high-hanging canopies that made gloom of the forest floor. The walls and bastions still loomed were not pulled down by the ages, their foundations buried, their torsos stained black, the blocks spangled with moss and lichens. In some places the rising tide of earth had inundated all, leaving only moss debris scattered across the forest floor, fragments that would be taken for mere rocks and boulders in a deeper gloom. In other places the loam and life had not so accumulated, leaving random stretches of nude ruin, heaped bricks, canted steps, walls finning the ground, the drums of toppled pillars.
Serwa led them across the destruction, her face flushed with excitement, her voice fluting in the manner Sorweel had heard so many times from girls her age, only about matters far more profound and tragic. The Sekarpai king thought he recognized some of the things she spoke of, either directly or through the slanted similarity of names. But far and away, most of what she told them he had never heard before, nor had he imagined that men, period, let alone those who had fathered his ancestors, had battled and strived and conquered in days that were thought ancient by the ancients. He had never heard of Kunawereshau, the first god-king to extend the might of his hand along the length of the river Omris, and aside from Soglish, he had never heard of any other cities that perpetually vied with Trisi for dominance. Atrithita, Lokor, and Umarau, whose might would grow to exceed that even of Trisi, and whose language would remain the Shaic of the ancient north long after she was broken by a people called the Khand. "Your people, Horse King," she said, her eyes alight with connections Sorweel could not fathom, "or the cousins of your ancestors, to be exact, born to the lands just north of what you Sarkarpi call the Pale. More than 3,000 years ago they cracked the walls of ancient Umarau and swept through this valley. Their ardor glutted. They spared all but the great works they found, and made slaves of those they would pillage." She spoke as if he should celebrate these facts, take heart in the far-flung incarnations of his people's blood. But again Sorweel was afflicted with doubt and wonder. To know a man among the Sekarpai was to know his father. And here was this woman telling him the truth of his father's fathers, the truth of himself. What did it mean to be better known by outlanders than by oneself? What kind of fools were the Sekarpai to find heart and honor, let alone self, in flattering fables spun across the ages? How wrong had they been? Even proud Harweel. They came to rockier ground, and she quickened her stride so much that Sorweel found himself breathless for trying to match her pace up the slope. A mysterious clearing opened between the trees, and for the first time they found themselves wandering among truly monumental works. Blocks of hewn granite, as tall as a man, and as long as four-wheeled wain. Some spilled, others assembled in cyclopean walls. She rushed forward without hesitation, wending through slots of stone, and inciting any number of curses from her brother. They raced after her. Panting, Sorweel paused before the sight of open sky, the blue so much deeper than the plains. He squinted against the sudden collusion of light and openness. A broad rectangle extended before him, heaped with stone ruin, yet miraculously devoid of overgrowth. The encroaching forest loomed about its perimeter as if leaning against some unseen barricade, or restrained by some unknown horror. He stood upon a far corner so that he could see the aisle of gargantuan pillars that braced the concourse in its entirety, as well as the lesser columns that lined its outer precincts. Most of them had tumbled, the smaller outer columns especially, but enough remained standing to conjure the sense of the whole, and to deliver the image of the long-lost ceilings to the soul's eye. So we watched a bee spiral from the gloom, then reel away to the edges of the clearing until it found a circumventing line. Even the birds he saw batting against the crowns of the surrounding elms and oaks seemed to avoid the open spaces, as if loath to dare the scrutiny of the stage. The Sekarpai king caught his breath, knowing he stood before an arena of lost glories. Phantoms. A place that had lived too fiercely to ever truly die. Oblivious, Serwa raced ahead, darted across the heaped stone, and between the monstrous columns that remained. "Behold!" she cried with girlish disbelief. "Behold the King Temple!" Sorweel and Moengus shared a hesitant glance. "Bah!
the Prince Imperial spat, running after her. Sorweel trailed, walking, trying hard to smile.
"How many times?" she called.
It seemed she jostled with long dead shades in his soul's eye.
"Stow your voice," her brother commanded.
But she just frowned and continued crying,
"Here! Here!"
looking about as though trying to orient her waking eyes with her sleeping.
"On this very spot, Podi, I have supped and celebrated with the High King, Selmomus, our little brother's namesake, and his knight's chieftain."
"Sirwa, please," Moengus cried, "recall what father told you. The skinnies are drawn to places like this."
"Stow your worries," she said, mocking his tone. "We leave no trail for them to follow. No trail, no mobbing. Even if we landed in the lap of an entire clan, they would be no match for me. I have reaped legions in the culling, Podi. You know this." She climbed a small rise that had been chapped to gravel, spun in a pirouette that made a wheel of her white flashing hair. "I stand upon the axis of an ancient power," she declared to the two wondering men. "The hub of a wheel that once turned the world, but now spins groundless in the smoky outside." She closed her eyes, raised her nostrils, as if breathing deep the uncanniness of the place, as if the occult were simply a more subtle perfume.
2,000 years ago," she called, "from this very dais, the first ordeal was declared against Golgotharath."
"Yes," Moengus replied, scowling. "That one failed." The rain began shortly after, spilling from a bank of woolen clouds that caught them entirely unawares. The sun just slipped into the sky's pocket, and endless waters followed chill upon the gloom. The two men ran to the shelter of Serwa's sorcerer's parasol, and together they hastened to the river. They could not see the far shore. Moengus had said nothing the entirety of the trek, and now, sitting side by side upon the muddled stone, his manner became even darker. While Sorweel gazed out into the fog shadows, he glowered at nothing, as if staring down hatreds only he could fathom. "Father says this river is holy," he finally said. He stood and began stripping his clothes. In disbelief, Sorweel watched him walk naked, following a shoal of sand and brush to where it dwindled to a finger prodding the water. He held his arms out for balance as he tiptoed to the very claw. He became shadowy as he passed through ever more veils of rain. He lingered for a moment, his powerful frame sculpted and gleaming. Then he leapt white and slicked out into the waters. He vanished in a pale whoosh. Sorweel and Serwa watched the rain fall, watched the white spitting across the iron-gray waters, threshing away the rings of his submersion, until they could no longer say just where the river had swallowed him. He did not surface. At some point Sorweel could feel individual heartbeats within his breast. Such was the horror rising within him. He peered across the descending roar, waiting.
"Something's happened," he finally cried.
He flew to his feet, but Serwa restrained him with a firm clasp upon his right hand. "He does that," she said in reply to his alarmed gaze. "Pretends to be dead."
"Why?"
Serwa frowned once again, far too canny and too wise for her youthful face.
"Surely Caeudas told you he was mad."
He gaped, and she laughed at his incomprehension, returned her gaze to the sparkling waters. Suddenly Moengus burst from the holy Omrus with an inhaling shout, his hair drawn like black paint across his face, neck, and corded shoulders.
"It tastes like dirt!"
he laughed across the washing roar. The holy Omrus. As the easternmost element of the great ordeal, the army of the south was the last to pass from the endless plates of the highest Yuli into the more broken lands of the northwest. Ravines and defilades scored the once simple distances. Monstrous stumps of stone breached the parch, formations that reared into saddle-backed summits. the men of the circumfix sighted ruins commanding bare rock heights, glimpsed the shadow of ancient and overgrown roads bisecting the horizon. Like their brethren to the west, they took heart in these signs, marveled at the places so far could have once been the center of mannish civilization. The sense of trespass fell from them, the aura of estrangement that makes wayfarers adopt the worried habits of the interloper. For the first time, they understood that they were returning, and not simply venturing, and their souls were fortified. They would have thought themselves liberators, were it not for the curtains of dust drawn across the horizon about them. They marched through the high heart of ancient Shenior, the weakest and most ephemeral of the three kingdoms of far antique fame, the frontier sibling of stern Eorsi to the north, and the populous Cunieri to the west. The Mandate schoolmen, who every night dreamed of these lands and their nadir, looked upon the desolation and mourned. Where were the whitewashed towers, the serpentine pennants of blue and gold, the companies of bronzed-armored knights, chieftain, cruel and proud? And they wondered that they had lived to see this earth with their waking eyes. With the breaking of the land came the quickening of the rivers, and with this came the increasing complications of crossing them. Across the high plain, the drought had so reduced the flow as to make fording a mere trudge through mire. Now the army crawled down into steeper valleys, where they found denuded poplars, stripped to spears by the retreating horde. The men of the circumfix took comfort in their campfires, the first in months, and feasted on what fish the netters gleaned from the rivers. They sucked the grease from their fingers, spoke small prayers, thanking war for their momentary reprieve. The believer kings, meanwhile, argued logistics and debated the perils of crossing treacherous waters in the shadow of the horde. The fords themselves were easy to find. The Shrank literally rewrote the landscape when funneled into multiple crossings, such were their numbers. Banks worn into ramps, waters stamped into broad morasses. They imagined a writhing, shrieking world, the skies gazed with dust, the worm-pale multitudes stamping and heaving, thousands flailing in the muddied waters, and they were troubled. The earth seemed to tingle with the memory of their raucous masses, like a sheet drawn from the body of a dead man. Everything reeked of pollution. The fear was that the horde would attack while the army stood astride both banks, a fear that never materialized. At the first such river, Karandusu actually remained behind with some hundred of his white and violet-gowned vocalati, thinking they could use the fords to rid themselves of the Shrank massing on the rear flank. They slew many, to be sure, thousands, sending plumes of foul steam into the already obscure air, but the Shrank discovered other crossings. Or perhaps they abandoned their armor and simply swam. Either way, the Nilnameshi schoolmen found themselves withdrawing across seething grounds. King Amrapathur continued taking precautions, but he became ever more confident that the rivering of the land was far more a boon to his host than a liability. He could not foresee the danger to come. The three camped in the ruins of a fortress halved by the collapse of the scarps that once motivated its construction. Dagmersor, Cyril called it. The remains of the citadel hung jagged and hollow above them, a tattered silhouette across the clouding stars. Unseen wolves howled. Sorweel drew the first watch. He picked a position above the moribund fortifications, where the land mobbed out from beneath his hanging feet. Nocturnal forests, solitary trees, climbed apart from their brothers, propped on swells of earth and rock, their crowns silver beneath the nail of heaven, their branches a veining black. Noise pitted the black with a million unseen places, a creaking, a creeping chorus that rose from the dark face of all, fading into the ever-expanding silence that was the emptiness of heaven. And it scooped the breath from Sorweel's lungs. There was a beauty to this journey across the ruined landscapes of lost Cunieri.
One do as much to these moments of solitude as to the world terrain that framed them. His thoughts wandered, as they often did, across the myriad spectacles he had witnessed since his father's death, and he wondered that someone so frail as him could participate in such legendary events, let alone move them. The things he had seen. He imagined what it would be like returning to Sarcarpus, excavating whatever scraps of his old life that remained, and trying to explain what had happened, what was happening beyond the pale. Would his countrymen marvel? Would they scoff? Would they accept the epic magnitude of what he described? Or would they dismiss it as mere conceit? The questions dismayed him. Until now, his return had been a thoughtless assumption. He was a son of the lonely city, of course, he would return. But the more he considered it, the more improbable it began to seem. Were he to work the goddess's divine will, murder the Aspect Emperor, surely that would mean his doom as well. And were he to deny the goddess, become a believer king at the risk of his immortal soul, would that not mean a different doom? And if he were to return, how could he describe, let alone explain, the things he had witnessed? How could he be Sarcarpi? Moangus loomed out of the dark long before his turn to take watch, and took a seat beside him. His manner as wordless and somber as the Sarcarpi king's own. Sowheel's alarm quickly subsided. Even after so many months of duplicity, he was not a man who could comfortably think treachery in the presence of those he intended to betray. In the siblings' company, he invariably gave rein to a certain amenity in his nature, one easily confused for cowardice. He could only plot in solitude. They sat in silence, staring out over the sunless tracts, soaking in the aura of companionship that often rises between speechless men. Since Sorwell did not look at the man, he remained a brooding shadow in his periphery, one laden with intimations of physical force and errant passion. "Your father," the young king ventured to ask, "do you think he has grasped God?" Sorwell would never know what motivated his honesty. A man, he was beginning to learn, could become as accustomed to contradiction and dilemma as to heartbreak. "A strange question for a believer king," the Prince Imperial snorted. "I could report you to the judges." Sorwell merely scowled. "Look about you," Moangus continued, shrugging and rubbing his shaven chin the way he always did when yielding to serious considerations. "All the earth rises to wage war against Father, and yet he prevails. Even the Hundred raise arms against him." Sowheel blinked. These last words pricked like a fistful of broken glass.
"What are you saying?"
"Truth, Horse King. Nothing offends men or gods more." Sowheel could only stare at him, witless. Was it possible for a god to be mistaken? But then that had been Aeschylus's lesson in those months past, had it not? The gods were but fragments of the god, mere shards of a greater whole, like men. Yet were, the schoolman would most certainly say, was just such a fragment, just as blind to the whole. Could the mother of birth be deceived? If the Prince Imperial noticed his bewildered horror, he betrayed no sign whatsoever. Moangus was one of those men who cared not for all the petty rules that measured verbal exchanges. He simply stared out into the constellations, twinkling low on the western horizon, talking as if no listening in the world could matter. "Of course Father has grasped God." The army of the south had come to Hoilusi, a province known in far antique days for the cultivation of flax. Hoilusi found its northern boundary in a river called the Irshi, which ran fast and deep for some 100 miles before mellowing on its path to the Nelios Sea.
Even in far antique times, the Irshi had been known for the rarity of its crossings, so much so that the ancient bardic priests often used it as a name for detour, and its crossing as a metaphor for death. Iri, Irshi, Gan Piral, they would say when speaking of fallen heroes, or of anyone who faltered in life. Cruel Irshi pulls them under. King Amrapathur and his planners knew of the Irshi, of course, but they had assumed, as was reasonable considering the 100 rivers they had crossed thus far, that it would also be droughted. They had even discussed the possibility of sending cohorts of schoolmen out in advance of the horde, in the hope of catching it crossing fords. They did not realize they had come to the first of many rivers whose high sources threaded the peaks of the great Ymeleti, that for vast stretches of its length, the Irshi had no fordable crossings. The horde found itself caught along its fanged banks. Multitudes were drowned, thrown into the gorges by the relentless press of their kin. Worm-white carcasses tumbled down the river's tempestuous lengths and formed macabre rafts along its idles, stretches of bloat and filth that sheeted the Irshi from bank to bank. But as the clans retreated out of the terror of the Shining Men, they soon began shrinking from the threshing waters as well. The raucous storm front that was the horde slowed, then halted altogether. Prince Masar Ab Kaskamandri would be the first to bear the tidings to King Amrapathur. "The horde, it no longer withdraws before our lances." The council was thrown into an uproar. What were they to do? How could they assail such impossible numbers, while masses more roiled about and behind their flanks? Karandusu was the first to upbraid them. "Can't you see that this is a boon?" he cried. "All this time fretting, wringing our hands because the skinnies outrun us, because we cannot kill them quickly enough. And now, when fate pins them in place, delivers them to our fury, we fret and wring our hands?" With the horde trapped, and with the mandate and the vocalati combined, the Grand Master argued, the culling would become outright butchery. He and his arcane brethren would lay carrion across the horizon. The believer kings turned to Aparin's Sakaris, who gazed at his rival with wary appreciation. "Perhaps the Grand Master speaks true," he said. And so the council fell to devising a new strategy. As men are prone, they took heart in what they thought was evidence of their own ingenuity. Prince Chirapatha alone harbored misgivings, for among the lords of the south, only he reasoned that the consult would also know of the Irshi, and so know it would catch the horde. He was not named the Prince of 100 Songs for nothing. He understood the advantage conveyed by the ability to predict a foe's actions. But he had taken his father's early admonishment to heart, and was loath to raise questions that might undermine the ardor of his Zadunyani brothers. And as much as he distrusted Karandusu and his posturing pride, the prince had come to regard Sakaris as a kindred intellect. The school of mandate marched with them. How could they fail? Sorweel dreamed of her bathing, trembled for the steam that rose from her gentle places. The waters were pure and translucent, sheathing and beading across her flushing skin. Wisps enveloped all. Then something crimson, something ragged and viscous, tentacled the waters, unlooped like spilled entrails, depositing scabrous filth across the clarity of her submerged form. But she knew it not, and continued to cup offal in her hands, pour filth over her naked skin. He called out, only to find himself splayed across forest turf, blinking at the midday sun broken through branches. He pawed an ant from his soft beard, saw Moengus sitting nearby. The Prince Imperial sat with his back against a tree, absently working his knife across his throat and chin, staring off toward the sound of his sister's singing, which rose with the noise of rushing water from behind tangled screens of foliage. She bathed, Sorweel realized, blinking away memories of his dream. She only sang when she bathed. Moengus turned to him for a moment, watched him with a preoccupied frown, then looked away when Sorweel hauled himself onto his rump. "What you said earlier," the young king said to the man, squinting against his grogginess, "about the 100 raising arms against your father." The Prince Imperial regarded him with a long and canny look. There was a brutality in his face, beyond the heaviness of his brow and jaw, one that made a snarl out of every glimpse of teeth. "I was afraid you would ask me that," he finally said. "I wasn't supposed to mention it."
"Why?"
A negligent shrug, as if he could trivialize catastrophic facts with mere manner. He was forever doing this, Sorweel realized, pitching his expression against the pious gravity of what he expressed. "Some truths are too offensive." Sorweel instantly understood. The people, the common people, would be quick to turn against the Anasarimber were they to know that the 100 actually sought, in their paradoxical, unfathomable way, to destroy them.
"But does it mean the gods can be deceived?"
And it struck Sorweel that there was something vicious in this, asking the son questions that could murder his father, or save him. Something more than simply devious. Serwa's voice floated across the moss-soft earth, hooking and curling to exotic cadences, lilting in yet another incomprehensible tongue.
"Entili matoi, jezili halami."
"Just believe, Horse King," the Prince Imperial said, holding his face at a partial angle to his sister's singing. Did she sing to him?
"Just believe, eh?"
A hard look. "My father wars against the end of the world. Stop thinking about your thoughts or you'll go as crazy as my sister."
"But you said your sister was sane."
Moengus shook his mane in shaggy negation. "That's what you say to crazy people,